From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. In the weeks before the recent listeria outbreak, thousands of Americans were likely exposed to bacteria-tainted cantaloupes, but most did not get sick. NPR's Allison Aubrey explains how healthy stomachs and quick immune responses help us fight off even the nastiest pathogens.
With more than 20 deaths linked to contaminated cantaloupes and about 100 cases of serious illness, lots of us may have been wondering, is it possible that I ate some of these bad cantaloupes? Food scientist Don Schaffner of Rutgers University says it's actually quite possible.
Probably a lot of people ate this cantaloupe. A lot of people probably ate a lot of listeria on the cantaloupe.
But did they all get sick? Well, in most cases, Schaffner says not really. Certainly not seriously ill, even though we're talking about some virulent strains of a pretty common bacteria.
Maybe they had an upset stomach. Maybe they didn't feel so good for a day or two, but it certainly was nothing worth going to the doctor about, and they probably recovered and they were fine.
The median age of the cantaloupe victims who were hospitalized was 79, close to 80 years old, as well as a few pregnant women. So what is it about younger people that gives them an advantage in fighting off foodborne pathogens? Well, for starters, experts point to what's happening in our stomachs. Ideally, we have a lot of acid in our stomachs. And when cells of bacteria enter the stomach, they don't find the environment too hospitable.
The bacteria come in many cases, they'll die in the stomach.
But this doesn't always happen when acid in the stomach is altered. For instance, when people take medicines to reduce acid reflux, well, studies show they seem to become more susceptible to stomach bugs.
We do know that people that eat a lot of antacids or who are taking proton pump inhibitors are certainly at a higher risk of food poisoning.
But when everything's functioning optimally, immunologists say the first and best line of defense against harmful pathogens really is the stomach.
Its primary purpose is to help us digest things, but it just so happens to work very, very well as a barrier against microbes getting further down into our gut.
Ross Kettle is an associate professor of immunology at National Jewish Health in Denver, and he says when bacteria do survive the stomach and make it down into our intestines, there is still another opportunity for our bodies to mount a quick response and fight them off. Basically, what happens is that our immune system sends white blood cells to the scene, and each one acts as a little foot soldier, surrounding and battling it out with the listeria cells.
The job of that white blood cell is to turn itself into its own killing machine to help grind up the bacteria that's inside of it.
And Kettle says since younger people's immune systems are typically more efficient at mounting this response, they tend to have an advantage.
So that is an important checkpoint, the ability to block it from making that invasion in the first step. That ability drops as you get older as well.
Kettle's colleague, Dr. Erwin Gelfand, also of National Jewish, says there are many factors that may increase a person's susceptibility to foodborne illness. For instance, when someone's fighting off the common cold, well, they may not be able to handle the attack of pathogens since viruses can alter the way the immune system functions. And then there's conditions such as vitamin deficiencies or even stress. They're known to alter immunity as well. Finally, there's the business of eating habits. Rutgers' Don Schaffner says, there's one favor you can do yourself when you eat fruit such as cantaloupe. Once you've bought it and sliced it, don't wait too long to eat it.
Use it up within a couple of days. Don't let it hang around. One of the unique things about listeria is that even in the refrigerator, the organism will grow and multiply slowly.
There's no way to completely eliminate the risk of foodborne illnesses, but understanding how best to battle back against the bacteria can't hurt. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Television cook Paula Deen is famous for enriching her recipes with a pat of butter, and then a few pats more.
And now, the ingredient that's going to make it so good and so rich, that's one stick of melted butter. I use a lot of butter. Because I can.
Many people on YouTube have watched Paula Deen make her donut burger. She calls her latest cookbook Paula Deen's Southern Cooking Bible. She writes that Southern food varies from place to place. New Orleans cuisine is different from Savannah cuisine, which in turn is different than in her hometown.
I spent my first 40 years, Steve, in Albany, Georgia, near the Alabama and Florida lines. And then about 24 years ago, it was 1987, I was relocated by my children's father to Savannah, Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And that is now and always will be home.
You say you were relocated by him as if he put
yes.
you put you on a hand truck and carted you up the...
And that's just about the way it was. That's just about the way it was. I was devastated.
Well, now, if you just go from Albany, Georgia to Savannah, Georgia, which is, after all, from one corner of one state to another corner, does the cuisine yes. change even in that amount of space?
You know, it really does. I found that when I went from Albany to Savannah... You know, that I needed to put that white rice away. And I need to turn that into Savannah red rice because they were big into that sausage, tomatoey, bell peppery rice mixture.
Now, you have a recipe here for what you call the best braised southern greens. I think mm-hmm. maybe people who don't eat greens don't get what it is about greens. Maybe you can explain, although you include the words bacon and butter in here. Maybe that begins to explain the attraction.
Well, you know, southerners have never been afraid of seasoning. It's kind of the other way around. Our seasoning is afraid of us. You know, and I think sometimes the South gets a bad rap. But I've found over the last 10 years that in all my travels, you know, there's nowhere in this U.S. that eats more vegetables than us Southern folks.
Mm-hmm.
We love our fresh green beans and new potatoes and fresh butter beans. So I figure that it's almost like a balance, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We're eating these wonderful collard greens and turnip greens, which are so medicinally good for you. And, okay, so what if it has a little ham hock in it?
Well, let me ask, is it Southern cooking without the bacon and the butter?
Mm.
I think I've stumped you.
Maybe a cheating version. You know.
Okay, so it's important. You got to have it. Maybe this is a good moment to ask what makes cheese grits, because you have them in here, good cheese grits as opposed to not so good cheese grits.
Oh, my gosh. The one secret to making good grits is you've got to salt that water before you add your grits. Otherwise, you can put a box of salt in it and it won't be salty enough. So that is the secret. There's a couple of secrets to cooking good grits. One of them is making sure that water is good and salty, making sure it's got some butter in it, just like, you know, when you cook your pasta, you put a little olive oil
mm-hmm.
in your water so it won't get gummy and stick together. And you want to make sure you use a whisk and whisk those grits for about 2 minutes in that boiling water. You want to make sure that all those grains of ground corn are all completely wet, because if you turn your back and don't stir them, then you've got a pot of golf balls.
I can picture that now. I think I've had it.
And you got to add a little milk at the end of your cooking time. And sometimes I'll accidentally trip when I'm walking across the kitchen with a block of cream cheese, and it falls in there.
I hate it when that happens.
I hate it when that happens.
And you just got to go with it, you know?
You just have to go with it and say, oops.
Right.
And, you know, people ask me all the time, Steve, do you and your family eat like this every day? Well, no, we don't. Of course we don't.
Let me ask about one more thing and take you back to Albany, Georgia mm-hmm. here, mm-hmm. because you include a recipe for what is described, this is your term, South Georgia caviar or redneck caviar. What is that?
Yeah. That's black-eyed peas.
Okay.
You know, we didn't eat much caviar in the South.
Imagine
although
that.
My grandmother would fry the best fish roe and serve it to us in the morning with scrambled eggs and grits.
Mm.
So that we ate our caviar in that form.
You know, because you mentioned your grandmother, I want to ask you one more thing. Does the
yes.
smell of certain foods in the kitchen remind you of certain people?
Yes.
Your grandmother would be one
yes.
of them, I bet.
Yes. And my mother and my father. I lost my mother and daddy when they were very young.
Mm.
And my daddy's favorite meal was chicken and dumplings. And I was 19 when he died, and he was just 40 years old. And I got in the kitchen with my grandmother after my daddy died, and I said, Grandmama, I've got to learn how to make your chicken and dumplings just in case this is a bad dream and my daddy comes back.
Mm. And she showed you.
And she taught me how. And it's not hard, but it's physically tiring because Grandma taught me that you have to make a tough dumpling. You want to be able to cut it with your fork. And in order to do that, you have to mix your flour and your salt along slowly with ice water. Well, I mean, that's a hard ball, you know, that you're having to work with. And it probably takes me 30 minutes to roll out that hard ball. But I know when I do that, that I've got them right. So it's work, but certainly worth it.
Paula Deen's Southern Cooking Bible is out now. Recipes are at npr.org, and you'll find a link to that video of her donut burger in my Twitter feed at NPR Inskeep. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The Occupy Wall Street protest movement that was born in New York about a month ago has spread to other cities. Most of the protests have been peaceful, but in Boston, police arrested over 100 people overnight, mostly for trespassing. What the demonstrators want often depends on the city and the day. And to check in on the movement, we have three reports now, starting with NPR's Tovia Smith in Boston.
Protesters have been rallying, as they say, in defense of basic American principles of equality and justice. What they were arrested for, however, was more about that other American tradition of defending your newly planted flower beds from being trampled by neighbors.
Get out of the park. Are you going to be locked up for trespassing?
Boston police insisted all night they respect protesters' right to gather. They just didn't want them doing it around the $150,000 worth of new shrubs and flowers on the Rose Kennedy Greenway. When protesters refused to move out, police moved in.
Put the other hand behind your back.
I can't.
Yes, you can.
You're hurting me.
Officers in riot gear cuffed and removed protesters with what Nadeem Mazin calls shocking brutality.
I did not expect to see people thrown to the ground. I did not expect to see older people thrown to the ground and punched in the face.
Protesters left behind, like Phil Anderson, immediately began collecting bail money for those he says were unfairly arrested.
I mean, I find it odd that they're protecting grass instead of people's free speech rights.
Boston Mayor Tom Menino is denying any police brutality. He says he sympathizes with many of the protesters' goals, but as mayor, he needed to maintain order.
Once you have civil disobedience, you do what you think you are going to run the city, I have to step in and make a clear line of authority.
Occupy Boston has posed no threat to anybody.
29-year-old Caree Peterson-Smith was one arrested last night, waiting outside court today for arraignment. He called the arrest shameful.
Who's wrong here? People occupying a public space to talk about the problems in our society and how things could be better? Or is it the banks that were camped out next to that are taking people's homes, ruining the world economy? They're at fault. And yet it's people from Occupy Boston who are in court today, not people from banks.
Raised by a grade school teacher and social worker, Peterson Smith says he taught school for 5 years before the recession left him unable to find a job.
And that's what this is about. We're not being allowed to realize our dreams, which are really dreams for making a better world in the ways that we've been told we should.
Peterson Smith says he thinks the arrests will provoke more people to join the protest in Boston. That may be, right now, under the unusually warm blue skies, but even protesters say changing New England weather may soon do more to whittle their numbers than any arrests. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Boston.
I'm David Schaefer in Chicago, where a day after a massive protest shut down rush hour traffic downtown, a smaller but growing and vocal group of Occupy Chicago demonstrators is camped outside of the Chicago Board of Trade, the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago, and Bank of America's Chicago headquarters. among the several dozen people here that are chanting, banging drums, and carrying anti-corporate signs are college students, low-wage workers, and the unemployed.
I'm Stephanie Harper. I live here in Chicago. I'm 50 years old, and I don't have a job right now.
Harper says she was laid off 6 months ago from her job as a certified nurse's assistant, where she worked with the elderly and the disabled.
Now I'm just looking for work, but I can't find any work. I feel out. I'm all over the internet all day long, every day, trying to find a job. But, I mean, it's hard when there's no money out here.
Where is the money?
I guess it's in the corporations, in the big bosses who got all the money, you know? Federal Reserve Bank, Wall Street, billionaires, they got all the money.
Carrying a sign that says people over profits, Stephanie Harper says this is the fifth time she's joined the Chicago protests. She says she's doing it not only for herself, but for her young grandchildren. And while the out-of-work Harper is someone you might expect to see protesting and denouncing corporate greed, Sheila Wukich is not.
I was passing by, and I read all the signs, and I totally agree with every single one of them.
So the 67-year-old retiree says she picked up a sign.
I used to work for a brokerage firm, so I know the ins and the outs, and I know that when all the banks got the power to be just like a brokerage house, that's when we got into trouble, and the banks got into trouble, too. So it's the people at the top that are causing the problems.
Wukich says if she sees some of her former colleagues walking out of the banks and brokerage houses in Chicago's financial district while she's protesting, it might be awkward. But she says she won't be surprised if some of them agree with her. David Shaper, NPR News, Chicago.
I'm Karen Grigsby-Bates in Los Angeles. I'm standing on the steps of City Hall looking at the park in front of City Hall, which is filled with tents from people who've come to occupy LA. Often there are large numbers of homeless folks who are camped out in the park before City Hall. This morning, there's a mixture of people who are homeless, who are occupiers, and who are people who are on their way to work, like Andres Bustamante.
I think that it wakes up America. I think that it wakes up not only the working class people, but it also wakes up especially middle class America.
Bustamante sounds a little breathy because he's a lawyer headed uphill to court. So I asked him, what does a guy in a suit with a briefcase have in common with these protesters?
What do I have in common with these folks? I grew up working as a migrant farm worker in the fields, and I can relate to working class people.
I interrupted Jeremy Brooks, a protester doing voluntary trash pickup, to ask what his overriding reason was for being here.
Jobs.
Brooks is from Pennsylvania, and he says, like many others here, he's unemployed.
I lost my job 4 months ago.
What did you do?
I was a cook.
Brooks says he'll stay for as long as it takes, and unlike the movement's interaction with law enforcement in some other cities, he has high praise for the Los Angeles Police Department.
Awesome. They have been absolutely wonderful to us.
That sentiment is echoed by Daniel Sendate, who has come here from Oklahoma City. He's sharing a tent with three other protesters. They all agree the LAPD, often criticized in the past for how it has handled protests, has done everything right.
They're the shining example of how a protest should be done. They're the ones that are out here actually protecting our rights, actually making sure that other agencies aren't coming around or harassing us.
Sendate says the LAPD's treatment of the park's occupiers stands in stark contrast to what he's hearing from other cities.
There's politics involved in every aspect of this thing, and the politics involved in that are that they're being seen in comparison with everybody else, and they're looking good.
That patience might need to last, as many of Occupy LA's participants say they're here for the duration, however long that is. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Any economic growth that depends on people attending pro basketball games will have to wait. The NBA has now canceled the first 2 weeks of its season because of a contract dispute between the league and its players. NBA Commissioner David Stern says the gap is too significant to bridge right now, while the union president Derek Fisher says a fair deal is not close. We at least have some fair reporting from NPR's Mike Pesca, who's on the line. Mike, good morning.
I will try.
So now, you know, if some relatives of mine were here, they'd probably joke that NBA players usually take the first several weeks of the season off anyway. So what's the problem here?
But yeah, and the first three quarters of most games.
That's the joke anyway. But of course, they're out there. They're tough. They're playing hard, except not now. What are the sticking points?
It's really money, and it can get a little complicated. But the players make about 57% of all the money that the NBA brings in, and the owners make 43%. And the owners have pointed out not only is that not fair, though they agree to it, it's hurting business. They say that 22 out of 30 teams are actually losing money. We could argue with that, and it's a good argument because there are other ways that owners have to make money besides what goes on to the bottom line of those sheets. But yes, there needs to be an economic reckoning. Both sides realize this. The players are saying we'll take 53%. I think the owners are holding out for closer to a 50-50 split.
But I'm curious, Mike Pesca, are player salaries really the reason that most NBA teams are losing money right now?
Well, it's a huge reason, and the average NBA salary is somewhere between $5 and $6 million. The NBA players will point out, but the median is over $2 million. Here's the problem. If the corrective is to point out that your average or median salary is only $2 million, it's not a very sympathetic stance to take, at least in terms of the public. And yes, you could always make this argument that owners are the ones who signed those contracts, but because of the structure of the deal, contracts are sometimes longer than the owners would like them to be, and also, frankly, longer than a lot of the fans would like them to be, because a lot of teams have these players on payroll that they're still giving money to that aren't doing much in terms of producing wins. So maybe a silver lining, if something gets worked out, a better deal could actually become fan-friendly if it gets better players who deserve the money on certain teams.
Help me understand the long-term trend of pro basketball, Mike Pesca. I mean, if I thought about pro football, they've got a certain trend having to do with the fan base, having to do with TV revenues. Where's basketball and all that?
Yeah, well, football is this dominant cultural thing that is setting all sorts of records for TV, and basketball isn't there. But given the fact that we're going through these terrible economic times, attendance has dropped a bit, but you know what? 90% of all arenas are filled on all nights, and it's kind of been that way at that 90% figure for many years. TV ratings were up last year. A lot of that was because people were very interested in one particular team, the Miami Heat. So national TV broadcasts could show the Heat, and the Heat made it through every round of the playoffs, so people watched that team, even if the Heat didn't win. Smaller regional cable networks are experiencing some drop-off, and there is a little bit of attendance problems. So in general, the tickets are fine, the merchandising is fine, player salaries are the thing that's the drag on the NBA.
Do they think they have a long-term positive future, though?
Yeah, I think they do. And I think that, you know, Steve Nash today, he kind of, via his Twitter feed, has been framing the argument as good as anyone has been on the player side. And he's been saying the NBA has experienced 60 years of growth. They are forecasting for more growth. And we, the players, have been actually asking for less money. So, you know, who's at fault here? But I think the owners would say, yeah, that doesn't matter. We're losing money. And this is why maybe in their negotiation, they could say, we could take this stance. We're very fine with not playing these games, because if you lose money, the fewer games you play, the less money you lose. At least that would be the owner's argument, where the players will say, we're taking the stands and it shows how solid we are in unity with one another. But, you know, every couple weeks they lose millions of dollars. They probably feel that pinch more than billionaire owners.
Do you think 2 weeks is going to be enough for them to resolve this?
Maybe, maybe not. Last time any games were lost, the only time was 1998-99 season. But we should just call it the 99 season because, you know, more than 3 months' worth of games were lost. Mm-hmm. You could still have a fine basketball season in that short amount of time, but some negotiating has to get done soon.
NPR's Mike Pesca, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
You hear him on Morning Edition from NPR News.
The Obama administration wants states to focus more of their attention on their lowest performing schools, where large numbers of students are failing state tests year after year. But some advocates worry that's shifting attention away from kids who are struggling at good schools. As NPR's Larry Abramson reports, many fear that minority and special education students will be ignored.
Mill Creek Middle School in Lesby, Maryland is sunny and bright. The halls are orderly, students look engaged, and in fact, most are passing state tests in reading and math. It doesn't look like a failing school.
We are by no way, shape, or form failing whatsoever. Do we still have some work to do? Absolutely.
Principal Rebecca Bowen sounds frustrated because, according to federal and state standards, this is a failing school. That's because low-income and special education students were a few points behind the goal set on standardized tests under No Child Left Behind. Bowen says she's already working on bridging that gap. She points me to a math class where the teacher is using a special intervention for students who are not yet proficient, according to state tests.
And so right now that young lady is working on informal assessment because she has received intervention. And they're seeing if she in fact was able to master the skill in which she received additional support.
These are the kinds of efforts that Maryland is likely to highlight if it applies for a waiver, so that schools like this one can escape the stigma of the failing school label. Calvert County Schools Superintendent Jack Smith says that word undermines all the good work the school is doing.
It really damages the sense of efficacy of the staff and of the students, and it also undermines the credibility of the school and the confidence of the families.
According to the administration's plan, Maryland should be focusing on truly failing schools, the dropout factories, where vast numbers of kids can't read or do math at grade level. Schools like Mill Creek, where most students are doing fine, could escape sanctions. In fact, the White House proposal would cut some slack to 85% of the nation's better schools. But even at successful schools, there are plenty of struggling students.
We may be just losing 85% of all schools.
Iris Bond-Gill is with the Campaign for High School Equity. She points out that the very reason No Child Left Behind was passed was that many states were ignoring kids who needed extra help.
Historically, we've seen that. This really has been the role of the federal government in terms of interventions with low-income students in low-income schools, and that's a role that we don't want to see the federal government backtrack on.
The Department of Education says no schools will get a complete pass under the waiver plan. To get those waivers, states must prove they have a system in place to ensure all students are making progress. Spokesman Justin Hamilton says the department will use one criterion when states apply for waivers.
Is it good for kids? Does it help prepare students for success in college and career and put them on a track for success in life?
State and local educators say there is no chance that things will return to the bad old days. They point to data tracking systems that gauge student progress and to programs like those at Mill Creek Middle School to help struggling students. Sandy Kress helped write No Child Left Behind when he worked for the Bush administration. He says the Obama administration's plan to grant carefully designed waivers is a big risk.
If they do this right, it's good. If they do it wrong, it's a step backwards.
The administration has portrayed the waiver plan as a chance to loosen federal strings and let education reform bloom in the states. But if the feds back off too far, some wonder whether some kids will simply fall off the map. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. For only the second time in its history, the NBA will lose regular season games because of a labor dispute. The first 2 weeks of the season have been eliminated as players and owners continue to haggle over how to slice the basketball pie. Right now, 57% of league revenue goes to players' salaries, and owners want that percentage to come way down. NPR's Mike Pesca is with us to explain. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
So the NFL, of course, went through a labor disagreement this year, didn't lose any games. Should we take the loss of NBA games to mean that pro basketball's economic situation is a lot worse than pro football's?
Well, there is that. I mean, the NFL is culturally ascendant and a cash cow, and the NBA is at best a cash, I don't know, goat, a sickly goat at that. Not every team is losing money. Officially, they claim that 22 of the 30 teams are losing money. But the NBA was hit a bit harder by the economic downturn. There's usually about 90% attendance in NBA arenas. And it's a fact that the NBA isn't very financially healthy. So that is definitely something that's true. I think that NBA players should be very careful about saying, well, the NFL did us almost a similar labor dispute to what we did, and they survived and they were fine. I think public sympathy was much more on the side of the NFL players, because NFL players put their bodies on the line. They have very short careers, 3 years on average, and their average salary is just over $1 million, whereas NBA players' average salary is between $5 and $6 million, and it's not as physically grueling. So if they think it's going to be exactly the same situation as the NFL, the NBA players may be in for a surprise.
Mike, both the NBA and the players say they regret the loss of games, of course, about 2 weeks, but that the other side's proposal was just unacceptable. So who do you think has a better argument?
Well, it's tough to judge, of course, and that would be buying into a lot of their assumptions. I mean, the players, their initial bargaining position was, we'll give back 4% of what we were getting the last collective bargaining agreement. They simply do not believe that the owners are as poor as the owners are saying. If you take the owners' argument at face value, then why wouldn't they want to lose games? Every game is just a chance to lose more money. But there are very good reasons why you shouldn't take it at face value. Among them are the fact that to compare earnings is a little disingenuous, because even if NBA teams break even on the ledger sheet, the resale value of franchises is usually very good. So an owner could not technically make any money for the entire length of owning a team and then sell his team at a huge profit, because a lot of people like owning NBA teams.
Mike, how would a truncated NBA schedule work?
It worked in 1998-99. We should just call it in 99, because they lost the first few months of the season.
Right.
50 games were played. And I have to tell you, people don't look back and say, oh, the Spurs that won the championship that year, they weren't a real championship team. They don't say that the Spurs really have fewer championships than they have. I mean, it was seen as a legitimate season. 50 games are a lot. You could do a lot with 50 games. And they would have a full playoff schedule, presumably.
Is there any way we could lose an entire season of pro basketball, though?
Talking to experts, they think it's unlikely. Even though right now it seems dire and the sides portray themselves as so far apart, there comes a time when players realize we are never going to get this money back. And owners, though they're crying poor, they're never going to get this money back. So you rattle the sabers as much as you can, and maybe you come to a deal, hopefully, in the next few weeks.
Mike, thanks.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca in New York.
This is NPR.